Romans 12, verse 15 says, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. And that is the title of my sermon. I could title it just with one word, and that is compassion, because that really sums up what that verse means, that we should have compassion for others. The prefix C-O-M, com, means with, and then passion means feeling. So to have compassion means you feel with somebody or you feel for other people. This is a big part of loving your neighbor as yourself. Now, that whole chapter is wonderful, as you know, and I'm going to read a couple other verses in that chapter to show how that some of these verses really tie in with each other. So in verse 9, it says, I kept turning the wrong page here. It says, but let love be without hypocrisy. In other words, don't just pretend to love. Abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. So we need genuine love, of course. And then verse 16 says, be of the same mind toward one another. Do not set your mind on high things or high up people, but associate with the humble. Do not be wise in your own opinion. So really have humility and love for everyone. And there is a parallel scripture here in the New Testament, and that is 1 Corinthians 12. And I'm going to read that two-verse passage. 1 Corinthians 12, beginning in verse 25. This chapter is comparing the church with the human body. And so in verse 25, it says that there should be no schism or division in the body, that is the church, but that the members should have the same care for one another. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. Or if one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. So that has very much the same meaning. Psalm 145, a verse that says, God is gracious and full of compassion. In fact, there are several Old Testament scriptures that describe God as being full of compassion. And there are four verses in the Gospels that say that Jesus was moved with compassion. In other words, when he saw people suffering, like people who were sick or suffering in some way, he was really emotionally moved at what he saw and realized, and moved with compassion. I looked up the word compassion in a Bible encyclopedia. It's one of my favorite places to consult. It's the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. It's like there's five volumes. It says, compassion in the Bible is a fundamental and distinctive quality of the biblical concept of God. And to its prominence, the world owes the word more than the words can express. In other words, the statement means that this is an extremely important fundamental quality of God. For example, what pagan god is known for in compassion? Generally, pagan gods are associated with being harsh and stern. If you get out of line, you're just destroyed like an insect. Or you offer up other human beings like babies as sacrifices and so forth. Pagan gods are never known for compassion. But that's one of the things that distinguishes the true God, is that he really does have compassion for all human beings. The encyclopedia goes on to say, all who call themselves children of God must necessarily cultivate compassion and show mercy and try to imitate God in that way. It also says the Bible teaches compassion for all people without exception, even to enemies, which is surprising at first. And then it also says true Christianity may be said to be distinctively the religion of compassion. In other words, there's no other religion that stresses compassion nearly as much as the Bible and the true Christianity. Now, the Bible emphasizes actions over feelings, and so in most of my sermons, I am stressing actions more than feelings, but this subject certainly involves feelings and thoughts as much as actions. But of course, feelings and thoughts are supposed to lead to actions. In other words, when the Bible says to rejoice, it doesn't mean just to feel a feeling of joy, but to express it. And when it says weep, it doesn't mean just feel sad inside. It means to show that you're compassionate, that you're sympathetic, that you care, that you're feeling what they're feeling, and that you're sympathizing and empathizing and trying to be supportive. Other words that are related, of course, are love and mercy, being tenderhearted, gracious, having affection, having pity. Over in 2 Timothy 3, here's a famous passage that is quite often quoted because it covers so many of the terrible things happening in the latter days. Verse 1 says, "But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come. For men will be lovers of themselves." So if you're a lover of yourself, it means that you're loving yourself way above everybody else. There is a right way to love yourself. You know, the commandment says, love your neighbor as yourself. Well, if you didn't love yourself at all, then how could you love anybody else? In other words, we instinctively care about ourselves. In other words, when we're hungry, we want to get food. When we're in pain, we want to stop the pain. We instinctively want to take care of ourselves and feel comfortable. And so what the second great commandment is teaching us is that we should be just as concerned about the needs of other people being met as our own needs being met. But this passage says lovers of themselves means they're narcissistic, they're infatuated with themselves, selfish, self-centered, and so forth. Lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power, and from such people turn away. Boy, we see this occurring more and more in our society, don't we? Now, when it says in the beginning of verse 3, unloving, that doesn't do justice to what the Greek word means. The Greek word is astorgos, which when you put an A in front of a word, it means the opposite. It means not. So storgos is a Greek word for affection. And so the King James actually has a better translation, because I'm reading from the New King James, but the King James has a better translation because it says without natural affection. In other words, people are not having the normal, healthy kind of affection for other human beings that we should have. They're hard-hearted. And so we're seeing more and more abuse, cruelty, meanness, bullying, being sadistic, even torturing people. People hating so much that they would just want to kill somebody. People hating policemen, so they want to kill policemen. It's just horrible, the cruelty and the hard-heartedness of so many people. So that verse in Romans says rejoice first, and then it says weep secondly. But I'm going to talk about the weeping part first, and then we'll get to the part about rejoicing. There are quite a few books written on grieving. And they vary a lot as far as how accurate or how beneficial they are. And one of the most famous was written a long time ago, which stresses that there's four stages of grief. But the more I've come to learn, the more I disagree that that is normal. Because what that implies is that you're going to have these negative feelings of anger and disillusionment and shock and deep sadness and all for just one stage, but then you move to another stage and you're supposed to quickly move through these stages, and so that finally, fairly soon, you reach the fourth stage, which is, you know, you have this peace of mind and you're pretty happy again and all that. So it implies that grief is supposed to be something that is a sort of a problem to deal with at first, but then you somehow got to solve this problem. Somehow you got to get rid of your grief and replace it with more of a healthy state of mind, because that grief is not really healthy, and that should be overcome. But this a few weeks ago, in that newsletter that is sent out primarily by Victor Kubik to all the church members, generally speaking, Mark Welch, who's now over the Ministerial of Member Services, he usually has a section in there that he writes. And so a few weeks ago, he wrote about how he had heard the sermon by David Wallach out in California, who lost his wife Carol, I think about 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, and how he still was in grief over that, and how that, but Mark Welch was referring to a sermon that he gave that was very helpful, and David Wallach was getting a lot of his points from this one book, and I was impressed with the points that he brought out, and so I ordered the book myself, and I'm in the process of reading it now. And in fact, I've got the book with me out in the car if any of you want to see the book. But the title of the book is It's Okay That You're Not Okay. It's Okay That You're Not Okay. The author lost her husband suddenly in a drowning accident. She actually saw him drown. And of course, they had a good marriage, and she was just completely devastated. And she talks about all the unhelpful things that people would say. And some of it is just, you know, just mildly uncomfortable, and some of it was very uncomfortable to hear or to be asked. And it's kind of hard to know how to answer the question when people say, are you okay now? Or how are you doing now? And it's like, well, I don't know if I can give you a short answer to that. And a lot, like in my case, I can say, well, in a lot of ways I'm very okay. In other ways I'm not okay. And so it's hard to answer, but it's not surprising that people would ask a question like that, because they kind of want to feel you out and how you're doing. But sometimes then they start giving suggestions about to be helpful. Now they want to give comfort and solace and all, and give their condolences and expression of sympathy, which often most people do express sympathy during about the first month, and then, you know, and you don't expect people just to keep expressing things like that, you know, month after month after month or year after year. But it's like, okay, I've done my part, I've expressed my sympathy, and now I'm moving on to thinking about other things, and so, you know, I hope that you can move on now and start thinking about other things and not dwell on that anymore. In other words, they're hoping that that by sending you I'm certainly not downplaying the value of sympathy cards and sweet notes. It's really touched me greatly to read the cards. Many cards have very nice messages printed in them, and then the personal notes that people have written inside those cards have been very meaningful and very encouraging and comforting, and I really appreciate them. But what I'm talking about is the underlying wrong view in our society that because we emphasize happiness so much that if you're not really feeling highly happy, that you know, that's kind of like having a disease or something. You need to get a cure for that, and so it's like let's move on. Let me just mention some scriptures. Ecclesiastes 3 and verse 4 says there's a time to weep, and it also says there's, in the same verse, it says there's a time to mourn. So it's very much a part of life. Just to show you the emphasis in the Bible on mourning. First of all, it's always been a little bit surprising to me, and when I did not understand this subject as well, I always felt a little bit puzzled by one of the Beatitudes. The Beatitude that says, "Blessed are they those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." And I thought, well, that implies that we should try to mourn when it's time to mourn. But why would I ever want to try to mourn? I mean, doesn't that something just happens automatically? In other words, if I'm sick, I'm going to mourn the fact that I'm sick. If I lost a loved one, I'm just automatically going to mourn. I'm going to feel sad. So I'm just associating the word mourn with feeling sad. And I'm thinking, well, that's just kind of an automatic thing. I don't need to try to mourn. But we need to think about that verse. It means that there's more to it than just what automatically happens to you. It means that don't try to just get rid of it. Don't just try to do away with it. I mean, if you are automatically mourning, well, don't try to just cut it short and try to replace it with something else right away. Or feel like, well, okay, I put in my one month of mourning, and so now it's time, you know, to move on and stop. So it implies that there's more to it than just what you automatically do. It also implies that it's something to be expressed. In other words, it implies that there's more to it than just an inner feeling that you automatically have, that mourning involves more than that. And so Ecclesiastes 3 and verse 4 says there is a time to weep and there's a time to mourn. Jeremiah was a very compassionate prophet with very strong feelings. And sometimes he's referred to as the weeping prophet. And the most striking verse of all is Jeremiah 9 in verse 1. And I'm going to read that to you. Jeremiah 9 in verse 1, where Jeremiah says, "Oh, that my head were waters and my eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people." And so other verses speak of how he would weep at the conditions that he saw and the suffering of the people there. I'm going to turn to Ezekiel 9, beginning in verse 3. Some of you might just remember what that's about just because I tell you where it is. Ezekiel 9, beginning in verse 3, says, "Now the glory of the God of Israel had gone up from the cherub, where it had been, to the threshold of the temple. And he called to the man clothed with linen, who had the writer's inkhorn at his side. And the Eternal said to him, 'Go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and cry over all the abominations that are done within it.' To the others he said in my hearing, 'Go after him through the city and kill. Do not let your eye spare, nor have any pity.'" So that's a little shocking, and I don't know that I fully understand it and what it means and implies, but this was a very powerful thing that God said. that I want you to notice and remember who is sighing and crying about the abominations instead of just ignoring them and not feeling anything. But the last part is hard to understand, where it says those that are not sighing and crying, they should be killed. But that's just a powerful verse about sighing and crying about evils and abominations and tragic things. And now I'm going to go to Psalm 56 and verse 8. Psalm 56. There's a lot of other scriptures I could turn to. I'm just turning to a few here. Just to show you that this is a prominent subject in the Bible. Psalm 56 and verse 8. Where David writes, "You number my wanderings, you put tears, my tears, into your bottle. Are they not in your book when I cry out to you?" So he's saying that he, implying that he sheds lots of tears. But God notices, and it's almost like God is saving them and putting them in a bottle. Now to go to the New Testament, 2 Corinthians 2. 2 Corinthians 2 and verse 4. Paul writes quite a bit about all kinds of suffering that he went through. And I'm talking about terrible suffering. And most of what he says about it is in the book of 2 Corinthians. So there's several places in the book of 2 Corinthians he's talking about the many types of things that he has suffered. I think what he was doing is, I mean, obviously what he was doing, he was trying to get a lesson across to the self-righteous people in Corinth that are supposedly in the church at Corinth, who felt sorry for themselves and also acted like, well, they were really sacrificing and all. And he is saying, look, if you think you're sacrificing, you know, how about what I've gone through? Because they were criticizing Paul when Paul has sacrificed and suffered a hundred or thousand times more than what they had. But anyway, in this verse, 2 Corinthians 2 and verse 4, he says, "For out of much affliction and anguish of heart I wrote to you with many tears, not that you should be grieved, but that you should might know the love which I have so abundantly for you." So one of the reasons why he was shedding a lot of tears is because he loved the people and he hated to see them suffering, and he felt bad that they oftentimes were making very poor decisions and judgments and had wrong attitudes and bringing it upon themselves. You know that book that I'm reading, It's Okay That You're Not Okay. In other words, the author is saying, you don't need to apologize that you don't feel well, that you still feel sad, that you feel devastated, that you feel confused, you feel disoriented, you feel lonely, your world is totally upside down in many ways. And so you don't need to apologize, and you don't need to feel ashamed of that. And some people will kind of shame you, like, oh, don't you think it's about time that you got in a more upbeat attitude? Why don't you try this? And or one of the worst things was where people assume that if things are going well in your life, that God's blessing you. You must have been doing some good things. But if things are not going well, you must be cursed. God is punishing you. You must have some hidden sins in your life. And so that's the worst kind of thing. But there's other things that imply that, well, you really shouldn't feel sad and so lonely and everything for such a long time or be taking it this hard. I mean, after all, you know the truth. You know they're going to be resurrected. Just be thankful you had a long life and you had a good marriage together. And, you know, you should just be feeling very thankful instead of feeling sad. And there's truth in most of those things. It's not that those things are wrong, but if that's all that's being said, you know, it's just like it's downplaying the grief. You know, it's like, well, let me remind you of all your blessings. Are people giving you happy cliches and platitudes? And part of it is that people feel uncomfortable somewhat around other people when they're down. Most of you probably have heard the expression, laugh and the whole world laughs with you. Cry and you cry alone. In other words, people want to be around you if you're happy and you're uplifting and you're funny. But if you're sad, you know, it's like, well, you know, bye-bye. You know, you're kind of a downer. So bye-bye. It's like, well, I want you to quit being sad because you're kind of making me feel sad. And I don't want to feel sad, so I don't want you to feel sad. I'm just saying, not that people consciously think those thoughts, but I mean, I just, underlying that can be a kind of psychological thing that people might be feeling underneath. And it's like, well, I've kind of run out of words. I don't know what else to say. Rather than just feeling uncomfortable and not knowing what to say, I guess I'll just move on. You know, I first began to learn this lesson when my little brother died. I was just 11 years old, and he was 3 and a half, and just so cute, just such a darling kid, and he died. And it was completely devastated my family. That was the first death of anybody close to us that had died in my family, even in my extended family. I mean, I had all my four grandparents were still living and so forth, and so we had never really experienced the death of anybody close to us, and I mean, it was a total shock. And my mother, she wanted to talk to people about Roddy, and she wanted to talk about her memories and what she was remembering and the things he did and said and how she felt and all that. And oftentimes people would just kind of listen, mostly in silence, and then they would change the subject as if they're doing her a favor, like, well, I'm going to help you get your mind off of it. So that, well, what about this? And I hate to hear about this. And, you know, change the subject. And it was so frustrating that hardly anybody would want to listen to her. So that made a big impression on me. As to that people need to have good listeners. People really hear you out. I'm going to turn to Genesis 37 and verse 34. This is just to show you how that mourning used to be much more of a part of what was considered normal, and it was the people expressed it more. And so when Jacob was told that his son Joseph apparently had been killed because they brought home this coat with blood on it, and they kind of trying to prove that Joseph had been killed. And so then it says in verse 34, then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, I shall go down into my grave, into the grave, to my son in mourning. Thus his father wept for him. Now that shows you how deeply people felt and how they expressed it more. And by expressing it, you actually heal more. People who do not grieve kind of bottle it up and stuff it and don't let it come forth more to the outside. And oftentimes they develop more mental problems in the long run. And that does become a problem. You know, if you develop some kind of a complex and a mental problem in the long run because you just would not let yourself grieve after the major loss. Now, let's go on to Genesis 50. Genesis chapter 50, beginning in verse 3. Now, this is when Jacob died. And so in verse 1 it says, then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And then verse 2, and Joseph commanded his servants and physicians to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for him. I guess that means for mourning. For such are the days required for those who are embalmed. But the Egyptians mourn for him 70 days. So they officially mourned for 70 days because he was so highly respected and loved. And then in verse 10, because Joseph said he had promised his father that when he died, he would be buried in Canaan and not buried in Egypt. So then the next few verses talk about him traveling back to Canaan to bury Jacob. So then in verse 10, it says, they came to the threshold floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, and they mourned there with great and very solemn lamentation. He observed 7 days of mourning for his father. So they'd already mourned 70 days in Egypt. Now they get to Canaan, and at the time of the burial, they're mourning for 7 more days. Now, we don't know exactly what they were doing and how they were expressing it, but I'm just making clear that mourning and grieving are not bad things. They're not mental problems. They're not something to be avoided and to get over with quite quickly. Now let's go to the classic example of Job and his so-called friends. And I'm going to turn to the second chapter of Job. This is after we learn about what happened. So we come to the second chapter of Job. And then in verse 11, now when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, for they made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. And when they raised their eyes from afar and did not recognize him, they lifted their voices and wept. And each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven. So they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. So far, so good. At this point, for 7 days, they were doing the best thing they could have done. In other words, there's no words that would be very helpful, especially immediately like this. And what can you say to really be all that helpful? So doesn't this illustrate what Paul wrote in Romans 12, weep with those who weep? They went and just sat and didn't say anything and just wept. And so the author of this book that I'm reading is saying that people do need support, but you are to be with them in their mourning, not to try to pull them out of it. In other words, you're not trying to be there to be a problem solver with some kind of easy fix, but you people want to know that you care enough to spend time with them, and that you do want to listen, and you want to be there for whatever help they can be. I mean, in some cases, it means a lot when they're so overwhelmed that just somebody who offers to take care of some physical things. You know, let me come wash your dishes. Let me come mow your lawn. So you have less on your shoulders. You know, when I talk about anything related to Elsie, I never know when I'm going to choke up. It usually happens when I'm trying to talk. But I know you've all read the book of Job. So far, so good. But then after this, most of the rest of the book is these three friends trying to be the problem solver. Well, Job, you shouldn't think this way. You shouldn't feel this way. You shouldn't say those things. You know, you're sort of in a bad attitude. You know, you're questioning things. You're kind of questioning God. You're kind of questioning God's judgment. You know, what, Job, come on, fess up. You know, you must have been doing something really bad, you know, to bring all this, because, you know, you're obviously being punished, and so you must have been doing something bad. And so what then they're adding greatly to Job's suffering. He's not only suffering for the fact that he's lost his children, he's lost all his belongings, he's lost everything but this nagging wife, a critical wife. So he's lost everything. He's absolutely devastated. But then they're rubbing salt in the wound. They're making matters much worse because of all the second guessing and the accusations and the shaming and the questioning and the self-righteous attitudes toward him, so forth. And it's like, well, nobody would be going through this if they hadn't been doing something bad. So the book of Job is so summed up by that verse in Romans, weep with those who weep. And it is so, and in a way that verse sums up that entire book I'm reading. That book is 250 pages long. Paul summed it up with those few words, weep with those who weep. Now I want to turn to Luke 13, which very clearly points to the problem of people assuming that when good things happen, it's because you're being rewarded. And when bad things happen, it proves that you're being punished for it. So this is in Luke 13, beginning in verse 1. There were present at that time, that season, some who told him about the Galileans, whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. And Jesus answered and said, do you suppose that these Galileans were worse sinners than all other Galileans because they suffered such things? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. So he's saying, just because something really bad happened, it does not mean they were worse sinners. You know, there's another verse in Ecclesiastes which says, time and chance happens to them all. God has given us freedom. He lets time and chance happen. Now, if you're close to God and if you're praying and you're praying for protection and so forth, I think many times, I know many times God is protecting us, and many times God does answer prayers, and many times God heals. But it's not like he's going to keep every bad thing from ever happening to you. He's going to let all of us suffer in various ways. And what counts is that we endure to the end and we're in the kingdom. And not that you expect. I know I baptized somebody one time, and a few weeks later, he says, well, I'm quitting. I'm quitting the church. And I was totally shocked. And why? He says, well, I thought my problems were going to go away if I got baptized. And he said, I've still got the same problems. So, you know, that was all a waste of my time and effort. So he just quit. I mean, I thought, man, I wish I'd figured him out before I baptized him. Then in verse 4, Jesus says, or how about those 18 on whom the tower of Siloam fell and killed them? Do you think that they were worse sinners than all other men who dwelt in Jerusalem? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. You know, it's a fascinating thing to read the parable of the Good Samaritan, how the priest came by and he didn't try to help the injured person. And then a Levite came by and he didn't try to help the injured person. But then a Samaritan came by who was generally despised by the Jews, and he did help him. Well, we always wonder, well, what was going through the mind of the priest and the Levite? Well, one thing that may have been going through their minds is that if this guy's injured, he's probably been doing something really bad, and he probably deserves to be injured, and he probably deserves to die, or it wouldn't have happened to him. And so why should I help him when he's obviously being punished? Well, I would be counteracting God's actions in punishing him. And so that's probably part of what was going through their minds, to excuse the fact that they weren't going to sacrifice their time and effort to help the person. So that shows you that that has always been a problem throughout the history of the world. That's why when people were lepers or had some other serious health problem, they were considered outcasts. You know, you just go off and live in a cave somewhere. We don't want you around us. We don't want to even see you. Just get out of here. Get away. Because you're being cursed. And so when Jesus went there and he went up to them and talked to them and loved them and physically touched them and healed them and encouraged them, people were totally shocked that he would do that. Because Jesus Christ set the example of showing compassion for all people. And, you know, even on the cross, you know, he says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. So God truly does love everybody. This subject that I'm covering relates to two articles that I wrote back when we had Christian Living Magazine, and this was published and still on our United Church of God website. And the first one is called Supporting Those Who Are Sick, What to Do and Not to Do. Because a lot of times when somebody's sick or injured, people want to, you know, they want to be helpful, but a lot of times what they do is not helpful, but there's a lot of ways you can be helpful. Then there was a follow-up article the next month. It was titled Supporting Those Who Are Sick, Advice to Give and Advice Not to Give. And because oftentimes if you're sick, all of a sudden you start hearing from people you know and even people you don't know who want to give you all kinds of advice, including medical advice. Well, I tried this and this worked great for me, and so, you know, I suggest you do this. Or I heard this advertised and it's supposed to help with this. Why don't you try this? And the cure-alls. So oftentimes if somebody's sick, they've already done a lot of research on their own, and they don't need for people that are volunteering, lots and lots of advice and everything. But those are both pretty long articles. So this sort of relates to that, where people want to be helpful, but if they don't really understand these subjects and understand how other people feel and react, they can be doing more harm than good. I think you know what the word empathy means. It's more than just sympathy. If you've been through it, if you actually have been through something similar, you can empathize because you truly do understand. You know, sometimes when people say, oh, I understand how you feel, well, they don't. It's easy to say, I understand how you feel. But if somebody's, for example, in my case, if somebody has lost his wife and he says, well, I know how you feel, I know what you're going through, well, then I think, yeah, you really do, because you have been there, done that. And I remind you of what I read to you a while ago about 1 Corinthians 12, verse 26, where it says, if one member suffers, that all members suffer with it. When people are giving me comfort, it does teach me more about how to comfort others. I want to remind you what Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, 2 Corinthians chapter 1, where he begins his letter in this way. He says in verse 3, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, and the Father of mercies, and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all of our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God." Well, that also applies to being comforted by other people. In other words, when I receive comfort, it teaches me to be more compassionate. It's like I know how certain messages affect me in a good way, and I think, oh, I want to remember that so that I'll know more about how to reach out and express myself to others. And so by letting ourselves be helped, we not only give somebody else a satisfaction and the comfort and the reward in being able to help be helpful, but we ourselves learn from those. You know, some people respond to almost every prayer request and update by sending a card and a note, and that's quite a ministry. You know, I've told quite a few people, I said, you know, you've got a wonderful ministry in reaching out to everybody you hear about, even though you don't know them. I want to turn to 1 John 3, beginning at verse 14. It says, "We know that we have passed from death to light because we love the brethren. He who does not love his brother abides in death." That is a powerful statement. In other words, you're not alive spiritually if you don't love your brother. Verse 15, "Whoever hates his brother is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us, and we also ought to lay down our lives for the brethren." And then, "But whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth." I think that means let us not love only in word and tongue, but also in deed and truth. I want to point out something interesting. And back in verse 17, where it's in the New King James, it says, "and he shuts up his heart." The King James Version is more literal, and it says, "and he shuts up his bowels." The Greek word is the word that we get the English word spleen. In fact, the Greek word is pronounced, I think, the same way, spleen. And so they used to think of the seat of emotions as being your spleen or your intestinal tract, your bowels. And now we think of the deep seat of your emotions as your heart. Well, of course, your heart is just a muscle that pumps blood. But it's always been typical to think of something down deep inside of your body as where you have these deep-seated emotions and all that. And so it's interesting that it uses that word, the Greek word spleen, shuts up his spleen. You know, we don't want to shut up our insides. We don't want to shut up our feelings or shut up our hearts or whatever. Well, I think I've said enough. If you ever do want to understand this subject of what not to... One thing that's sad about this book that I'm reading is this woman apparently doesn't have very much respect for the Bible. She never mentions the Bible. And so I don't know that she considers herself a Christian or not. It's too bad that she can't combine her experience and her knowledge with the Bible. That would be too good to be true. So she doesn't bring in anything about the Bible. But she does bring about how people misuse religion. And so she does understand that, how religious ideas are misused. But her main point is that a grieving is not like a temporary problem has got to quickly be solved, and I've got to somehow get somebody out of that frame of mind and you know, come on, cheer up. You know, let's think happy thoughts. When, you know, you would really be cutting short the period of grieving. Now I want to go on to the other half of that verse in Romans 12, which is rejoice with those who rejoice. Because in a way, compassion relates to that as well. Compassion means to feel with somebody. Well, you don't only feel grief, you should feel their joy as well. But people are lacking compassion about that as well. It's like, well, so what if you're happy? That doesn't make me happy. So what if you had something good happen to you? Well, I don't care. It didn't happen to me. And so I just hope something good happens to me. And so people really do tend to lack compassion about joy as well. So I want to turn to Luke 15. This really illustrates the points that I'm making about this. Luke 15, beginning in verse 1. Then all the tax collectors and sinners drew near to him to hear him. And the Pharisees and scribes complained, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." So he spoke this parable to them, saying, "What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he loses one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the one which is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and neighbors, saying to them, 'Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost.' I say to you that likewise there is more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 just persons who need no repentance." So the main point is obvious, and that is God is concerned about every individual, and we should be concerned about every individual. We want to see everybody having an opportunity. And that's why the most exciting thing I ever learned when I came in the church was about the second resurrection. You know, I always believed that good people were going to be resurrected or go to heaven or something. Something good was going to happen to them. But I thought, I had no idea what was going to happen to everybody else. I thought, what's going to happen? Are they just going to stay dead? Are they going to go to hell? Or what happens to the vast majority of everybody else? It just blew me away when I learned about the second resurrection. I thought, yes, that's the answer. And I right away I thought of my little brother. I thought, that's how I'm going to see my little brother again. Anyway, that still, to me, that's the most exciting subject in the Bible. I love to give a sermon on the last great day of the feast because that's such an exciting subject to me. But so that what Jesus is illustrating about how that God does love everybody so much that he's going to give an opportunity for salvation to every single human being who's ever lived, which is awesome. And so that's his point, and that is that rather than despising people you consider sinners that are not as goody-goody as you are, you should want to help them and lead them in the right direction and encourage them and save them and try to be helpful. So that's his main point. But my point in talking about this is that it just seems totally unrealistic in our society that if you had 100 sheep and one went astray, that the way you would react is probably not the way Jesus described. It's like, who cares enough about individual sheep that you'd spend a lot of time and effort to go looking for the other one, the one? You say, well, I still got 99, so stupid sheep, shouldn't have gone right. So what if a wolf eats him? I mean, that serves him right for wandering off like that, and I'm certainly not going to waste my time and effort on just one sheep. It's not going to make that much difference in my income about that sheep. That would be one reaction. And then another reaction would be, well, I'm in a bad mood now because I've sacrificed my whole afternoon looking for that stupid sheep. And so I am not in a good attitude. I'm upset because of that stupid sheep. And another point is, who among my neighbors would give a hoot as to what happened to me? If I called up my neighbor and said, guess what happened today? I had a sheep that wandered off. And so I went looking for it, and I found it. And I can imagine a neighbor say, Well, why are you calling me about that? Why should I care? I mean, that's such a small matter that that's ridiculous. I'm busy and you're wasting my time calling me to tell me about something that happened in your life. And then another reaction would be, who would you feel close enough to? What neighbor do you feel close enough to who would care about even big things happening in your life, much less something small happening in your life? Now, it might be somebody in the church who that you're close to in the church would be more interested. But, you know, he says neighbor. In most people's neighborhoods, I hardly know people in my neighborhood because most people have electric garage doors and people have tinted windows. And so I can't see them in their car. They push the button, the garage door goes up, they drive in, the garage door comes down. I could go for years and never see a neighbor who lives two doors down. And it's hard to get to know neighbors unless you really make an effort. So who do you have a close enough relationship with who cares about what's going on in your life? And then who do you think would have confidence that your neighbor has compassion, that your neighbor is going to feel sympathetic toward you? And then he goes on with a similar story. Verse 8, or what woman having 10 silver coins, if she loses one coin, does not light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she has found it, she calls her friends and neighbors, her friends plural, and neighbors plural together, saying, rejoice with me, for I have found the peace which I lost. Likewise, I say to you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Can you imagine calling up friends plural and neighbors plural and saying, come rejoice with me? Now, a silver coin. I wonder how much he was imagining that silver coin to be worth. A dime, a quarter, a 50-cent piece, a silver dollar. Now, if you lost $100 bill, you know, I can see you sharing your story. But if anything less than that, your neighbors are going to say, well, what's the big deal over finding a little bit of money that you couldn't find for a while? Brethren, besides Jesus' main point, let's learn the point that I'm making. We should be deeply interested in one another and care enough that we do love our neighbors as ourselves. If you found a lost sheep, you would feel happy. But are you going to feel happy if your neighbor finds a sheep? You're going to feel happy if you find some money that you lost. But are you going to also feel happy if your neighbor finds something that your neighbor lost? We truly should love our neighbors as ourselves. And we should learn to rejoice with those who rejoice. You know, one of the most inspiring principles about true friendship is what Jesus said in John 15:15. He says, I no longer call you servants, but I call you friends, because all things that I've learned from my Father I've made known to you. Jesus was so open with his disciples. And that openness is a key fundamental principle of friendship. And so this communicating about weeping and grieving and rejoicing and sharing good news, this is part of being open with each other. Of course, we don't want to go overboard. Some people want to just tell you a long story and go into all these details, which are interesting to them. And a lot of times it's like, oh, I can't identify because I don't know those people you're talking about and I don't know those details and everything. So we have to be careful. The way to approach things a lot of times is to tell people a little bit. If they want to know more, they'll probably ask you, well, tell me a little bit more. And then you tell them a little bit more. And if they want to know more, they can ask you, tell them some more. But you don't have to tell them the whole story. I have to tell something on my son, Randy. He was always been the type to want to tell a complete story sequentially, starting time-wise from what happened at the beginning. So the classic was one time there was a water leak in our basement. And so my son comes running upstairs to tell his mother, my wife. He comes up to tell her about it. And so instead of saying, "There's water leaking," he's saying, "Well, Mom, I went downstairs, I heard something, and it sounded kind of funny, so I went into this room, and I looked around, and first I didn't see it, but then I saw it, and then I saw there's water coming out from under the door, and I realized, well, hey, there's a water leak." Elsie says, "What? Why did you tell me that to begin with?" So, I mean, you have to take everything in order like that, so you got to get down to the main point a lot of time. But we do need to be good listeners, and you know that's a good subject in itself, and that is how to be a good listener. Sometimes people have said, "Well, I guess you're one reason you're a minister is because you're a good talker." And I said, "No, I don't think I'm a good talker. It's been a slow process learning to preach, but I think more important for a minister or any kind of counselor is to be a good listener. And I've always tried to be a good listener to people." To hear them out and to really try to understand them and everything. So there's a lot of scriptures that tie in with this about having tender mercies and being long-suffering, being tender-hearted, walking in love for one another. Lots and lots of scriptures about love and loving one another and so forth. It's good to pretty often read 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter, which kind of defines what makes up true love. And thankfully that all of our sorrows are going someday, this scripture in John 16 is going to be fulfilled. John 16, because this life has lots of sorrows. John 16, beginning in verse 20. "Most assuredly, I say to you that you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice, and you will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will be turned into joy. A woman, when she is in labor, has sorrow because her hour has come. But as soon as she has given birth to the child, she no longer remembers the anguish for joy that a human being has been born into the world." I know I've several women have said when they were in labor, they thought, "Never again am I going to let myself get pregnant. This is terrible." And then after the baby's born, it's like, "Oh, well, let's have another one." So at the time, you know, it just can be overwhelming, I understand, for some women. But so then Jesus says in verse 22, "Therefore, you now have sorrow, but I will see you again, and your heart will rejoice, and your joy, no one." We take from you. Yeah, Revelation. It says the time will come when there'll be no more tears nor sorrow. That time is coming, and that's what we're all looking forward to. So remember, there's a lot of meaning in that one verse, that one simple verse. Rejoice with those who rejoice, and weep with those who weep.